Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, and welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast. This is your host, Peter Ott, and I'm here today with Tony Iliakostas, the host and founder of the sports law web show Law and Batting Order. He's also a sports law contributor for the website Law News. Tony is a graduate of Fordham University and an alumnus of New York Law School. He's also currently a business affairs manager in the Rights Representation Group at Corbis Entertainment. He's very active on Twitter and in the sports law world all over the internet. He's really doing a lot of things, and in a lot of ways he's been a role model for me, so it's a privilege to have him here with me today. To start off, Mr. Iliakostas, can you introduce yourself so we can better get to know you?
Sure. And Peter, thanks so much for having me on your podcast. My name is Tony Iliakostas. I am the founder and host of the sports law web show Law and Batting Order. I'm sure as we discuss later on in the discussion how I created it, just briefly, I created Law and Batting Order as a means to break into the sports law industry. I was very passionate about that industry heading into law school, and I found that reporting on sports law issues really was a great avenue for me to really get the word out, not only about sports law issues, but to get my own individual brand out in the open. And I've covered a bevy of issues from any criminal charges that athletes face to collective bargaining issues in sports leagues, and even some, you know, little isolated incidents here and there that obviously make major headlines, you know, like Penn State or some other big scandal that I can't think of off the top of my head. But I've been running the blog for about 5 years, and I just completed 100 episodes at the close of 2015, and it has really paid off dividends. I have been so blessed that I've networked with so many people, including you, Peter, and, you know, just the hard work has definitely paid off, and I can't wait to share the rest of my story with you.
Okay, well, yeah, thanks for making the time to do this. Why don't we just start off talking? I know you talked a little bit about your background. You said you'd planned on doing something in sports law. That's why you went to law school and things like that. I think a lot of people have that experience, you know, that they're like, oh, sports is cool. I can do law. I'm going to go to law school and we'll see what happens after that. Mm-hmm. It seems like you really had a plan going into it. Can you describe a little bit about how that emerged, and did you know it all from the beginning, or have you learned as you've gone along, or what?
Yeah. So I unfortunately went into law school with this very unfortunate view that I was going to be the next Jerry Maguire. I saw the movie right before I started law school. You know, show me the money. That was what it was all about. And you know, I did a follow up after watching that movie and I saw that it was based on the story of Lee Steinberg. And I thought to myself, well, Lee Steinberg graduated from law school. That definitely would be a feasible avenue for me to go down, you know, becoming a sports agent. So that was the mindset that I had when I was going into New York law school, basically wanting to become a sports agent and representing athletes. And it, you know, I knew that at that point I would have to sort of educate myself on labor and employment law, since one, I'm dealing with the employee being the athlete, and I'm also dealing on the labor side with the league, since they have their own collective bargaining agreements and they have labor rules and a labor union in those leagues. So that was the picture that I had in mind going into law school. And then that very quickly changed when I saw two very powerful ESPN 30 for 30 films. The first one was The Dotted Line. Fantastic ESPN documentary. I highly recommend for anybody to watch that documentary. And the second one was the one Broke, which obviously is critically acclaimed and everybody loved that. I also love it myself. And what I found was, one, if I had any shot at being a sports agent, it was that Jay-Z would have to be knocking on my door and telling me, come join Roc Nation. That was the only feasible way that to happen. Or somebody from CAA telling me, come join CAA. Because I knew that doing it on my own would be very, very hard financially, physically, and emotionally. And then second, I realized that being an agent sort of came with the risk of being in a society that notoriously has a bad rep. And, you know, not all agents are bad. I know I have a lot of friends who work in the agent business, and they are beyond ethical, and they really know how to get the job done. But But for me, there are those bad eggs, and I didn't want to mix in that bunch. And I felt that for me, that's just not who I am. I quickly realized that maybe being a sports agent wasn't the profession that was destined for me right after law school. So I really went into the rest of my law school career with that very open mind of where else I can go into sports law.
Yeah. And so you went into law school, and then from there, you've done stuff outside of just school as well. I mean, you created Law and Batting Order, things like that. Why did you do those extra things? Why didn't you just, you know, take a course in sports law? Or, I mean, I don't know what courses were at your school, but there you could just take a class and call it good and say, oh, I know about sports law now.
Yeah. So I didn't want to continue this in the previous question because I knew that my experience with the agent side really carried over into how Law and Batting Order was created. Now, I did take some follow-up classes after my first year that sort of allowed me to hone in on more specific stuff in sports law. That's where the IP angle comes in, and that's what I do now at Corpus Entertainment, where I'm managing the licensing and the publicity rights of living and deceased icons. So I'm dealing in that intellectual property space. It's not sports law-centric, but that said, right after my notion of not wanting to be a sports agent, I had to quickly rebound and ask myself, what do I want to do in the sports law world? How can I break into this industry? I knew nobody in sports law. I had no connections whatsoever. And really, I had to fend for myself. And I know it sounds so cynical when I say it, but sports law at that point was a very dog-eat-dog type of world for me because I needed to sort of find a way to get my foot in the door and find a way to sort of pass it everybody else in an attempt just to get in that industry. I needed to find a way to connect with somebody. I had no connections whatsoever. So it was actually the third annual Sports Law Symposium at New York Law School during my first year of law school that changed my life. And it was at that symposium that I met a lot of sports lawyers. And it was that same symposium that I sat through a Breaking Into Sports Law panel. And those panels, as much as they're so germane to every single sports law symposium around the country, they are very important because they can change anybody's life. And I'm a testament to that. It really changed my life. And all the panelists pretty much were saying the same thing in agreement, which is that in sports law, it's a very niche industry and you really have to succeed by building your brand. You have to be unique from everybody else. And I'm very much the type of person that I like to go outside the cookie cutter mold of being the ordinary law student or being the ordinary academic or being the ordinary industry professional. I wanted to do something that would definitively differentiate myself from everybody else, from my peers, from anybody else in the sports law community. So I sat after that panel, there was a lot of information, but that build your brand notion was just resonating in my head. And I sort of had an aha moment and I thought, why don't I create a blog? And I said to myself, that would probably be the best means for me to break into this industry. And lo and behold, it really, paid off. I mean, I was a communications major at Fordham and it was sort of a no-brainer for me to create that blog. The thing was, I wanted to do something different than the ordinary blog, which is written. At that time I did a Google search and there were tons of sports law written blogs at that time. And I said, I'm going to get lost in this stack of sports law blogs in a Google search. How can I be different? So I remember I had a Kodak ZI6 lying around in my desk and I had a tripod and I had my iPad. And I said, what if I make a makeshift teleprompter? Let me mount my Kodak ZI6 on my tripod and let me film an episode and let me do a video blog instead of a written blog. So I created concept art. I had it designed by a professional logo designer. I built my website on my very own. I subscribed to a service with Squarespace. And on December 23rd, 2011, Law and Batting Order was born.
Okay. Yeah. No. And I mean, you talked about how there's other blogs. There's a ton of things out there. A lot of them are really high quality. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with the Sports Esquires, with the White Bronco. Your website, obviously. I think as much as you say, like you're trying to differentiate yourself, I think you're one of the first people to really put out a really high quality place where people could go to learn, in short snippets and things like that. The video that is different and it stood out to me as I was in law school. So I think that is an important thing for a lot of people trying to find a way to be different, to add value, to not just be another face out there in the world because there's a lot of people out there.
Absolutely. And just a quick note about that. You're right. There are so many other exceptional blogs out there. And I'm a big fan of Dan Worley's work with White Bronco and I love what everybody at the Sports Esquires blog is doing. And there are a few other blogs, before today that were very prominent blogs. Obviously, the sports law blogspot blog that are hosted by all those academics. You know, they're great, but I didn't want to steal their thunder. You know, it was like I feel like I'm stealing their audience if I'm stepping into the game and doing another written blog. So definitely that video angle worked to my advantage, and I'm so thankful that I pursued a communications major at Fordham University that enabled me to pursue that avenue of legal journalism.
Okay. Yeah, no, and if I can just step in for a bit and share an insight that I think I have, like, I think people need to understand, like, you don't have to create a blog or something, you know, but it is important to interface with people in the sports law world, especially if you don't come from that world or know people in that world. And it's not hard to do, you know, like you said, your law school had this symposium that changed your life. I helped organize a couple of symposiums and meeting people and talking to people. These people come to symposiums because they want to talk about what they do.
Absolutely.
And so they're really accessible. And, you know, I got to know, you know, Sonny Vaccaro. He's like a legitimately famous, important person, mm-hmm. but he was willing to talk to me. And now he's, you know, kind of a mentor to me. And so, you know, I think people are afraid. They're like, oh, these people don't want to talk to me. They do want to talk to you, and you definitely should want to talk to them if you want a career in this space.
I am with you 100 billion percent.
So yeah, for law students, and I mean for anybody, it's important to meet people in this industry.
Yes, absolutely. That being ambitious is exactly what it takes to be in the sports law industry. And if you meet the right person who wants to help you, we will set the time aside. I know I will. I definitely know Peter will as well. We are always here to talk to anybody who just wants a bit of advice or just wants to talk sports law.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. So why don't we move on to talk a little bit about the process, about how you do what you do. I know you talked about setting up the tripod and things like that. So how does recording an episode of Law and Batting Order go?
All right. So let me preface it by saying all of this is a one-man show. It has been since the idea of Law and Batting Order was conceived back in 2011. It still is like this today. So first, I go to Twitter or I go to any major news outlet like ESPN, Fox Sports, ABC News, New York Times, wherever, and I try to see if there's a compelling sports law issue that has been discussed, but the legal principles haven't been extrapolated to the fullest extent. Or I talk about a sports story that has some legal implications embedded in it. So let's use the example. This is a very pertinent topic, but let's use the example of the sexual assault allegations against Peyton Manning. You know, obviously the statute of limitations have expired on that because this happened so many years ago, but it's worth talking about how he can't be criminally prosecuted. And maybe some outlets have talked about that. Others have explained it, but haven't explained it to the fullest extent. But in any case, let's say I pulled that story. So once I have my story idea, whether it's that or any other topic. It could be domestic violence related. It could be something in the civil courts, anything. Once I have the idea, I do a little research. So I'll hit up, you know, one of the websites like Westlaw, or in this case, I usually like to use the Cornell Law Institute. They have their public directory of statutes and all that. And I'll go to any other legal directory to help me do some research. And then once I have a good handle of what I'm talking about for the episode, I'll go ahead and draft my script. I'll do a little editing for a couple of hours. And then once that's done, I email it to myself, and then I pull that transcript, that whole script, onto my iPad, and I upload it to my teleprompter app. So then I set up my teleprompter. It's connected to the same tripod where my Canon T2i is connected. Make sure that it's charged and ready to roll. Once that's done, I sit at my desk, I turn on my lights, I do my little mic check at my desk, and then I just hit record and I just roll away. If I mess up, I get up from my chair, I scroll the iPad back up manually, and I hit record again, and I just keep doing that until it's a perfect take. Once that's done, I pull the video from my memory card, upload it to my computer, I splice it on Final Cut, I do my little editing that includes the intro music and the outro. If there are any rules that I mention and I actually want to do a call, you know, like a actual visual of it, I have like a title card that allows me to paste the law in my video so you can see what the actual statute says if I'm talking about a statute. Once that's done, it's pushed to Vimeo, and then I publish it Sunday morning so that everybody can see it. I put it on my website, and then I pretty much spend the rest of Sunday going into Monday marketing it, whether it's on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and also my email newsletter, which always goes out every Monday in the afternoon. And it's pretty much routine like that. I know it sounds so tiring. I'm sure that anybody who's hearing it right now is probably getting physical exhaustion listening to that very long list. But I will say, I was telling Peter off camera, off the record before we started recording, that the beauty of having done this for so long is that it almost becomes routine, and I haven't gotten tired of it. I haven't forgotten, and I haven't missed a beat of it. So it's definitely paid off tremendously, all this practice, and and I've perfected it far and wide, and in so many ways. I mean, if you go back to episode one, I look like I'm being held at gunpoint, whereas now I move my hands. I'm very verbal. I'm very articulate. I'm very exuberant in my reaction because I really want to make this a very interactive type of show. And by doing those little steps in the process, I definitely get the job done.
Yeah, no, that does sound like a lot of work, and I do an audio podcast. That's a lot of work too. But I'm glad that you're doing it because it ends up being a high quality product, and I know a lot of people are paying attention to it. So yeah, I mean there's obviously value there. As far as your experience with it, what have you learned from it, and what value do you find from doing it?
Well, I've learned that journalism is no easy industry whatsoever. You do these podcasts and you are a journalist in some way because you're reporting on the careers of other people and what they do in their daily life, especially within the sports law context. And I think you can agree with me that you evolve so much as you do more of these because you have a vision about your brand or whatever you want to represent initially. And then as you do these more and more, you see how the conversation shifts. As you talk to some people, they may give you tips or you'll get some feedback from your fans and audience members. And I've certainly had that fair share of feedback where some people say, this is great, but maybe cut this segment down just a little bit. My episodes used to have something called quick hits, where I used to give three very brief sports headlines. I didn't talk law. I just said, here are some quick hits from the past week. And I would say, such and such had a no-hitter, or this person won the championship in tennis. And as much as that was fun to sort of lighten the mood before talking about something dry like the law, I realized that not many people were engaged because, yeah, that was fine, but they were watching Law and Batting Order to hear about sports law issues, not to hear some guy from Queens, New York, wanting to talk about sports again. So I definitely heard everybody's critique on that. And now Law and Batting Order is exclusively a sports law video blog. That's all it is. I don't have the fluff in the beginning to reporting on sports issues. So I think that has been the biggest takeaway for me. I have developed so much because of that. And I think it's really been a benefit to me as I've continued to develop my brand as a legal journalist.
Yeah, and you're a journalist in that you have the blog, and then you also do this writing and other things for other websites. Do you have a preference between writing or doing a video thing?
I'm going to say this. I have newfound appreciation for writing, especially since I'm now writing for one of my all-time favorite legal journalists, Dan Abrams. I grew up watching him since I was a kid. He used to have a show called Verdict on MSNBC, and I know that he used to do some shows on Court TV, and he's been one of my favorite legal journalists ever, followed by Chris Cuomo. I think he's very good as well. And I found that working as a contributor for his site has really allowed me to sort of not be so, I mean, I am expansive when I write my pieces for lawnews.com, but I've learned that the attention span of somebody is very limited today. And here's an alarming stat that I do want to share. I think it was in 2008 or 2009, the attention span of somebody was about 13 seconds, actually 12 seconds. Today, it is 8.5 seconds. That's 0.5 seconds less than a goldfish's attention span. So that is alarming. So I knew that whether it was with writing or video, I had to get the person's attention right away. And thankfully, I've been able to do that on the writing scene with Law News, and I definitely have some newfound appreciation for it. That said, video still has a very soft spot for me in my heart. I think video is a very powerful tool because as much as you're only limited to seeing something within the four corners of your screen, you have almost a personal connection to the person or the scene that you're watching. So whenever you see me, I look straight in the camera, and I'm hoping that you feel like you have a personal conversation with me as I'm explaining these legal issues. And I hope that as you see how I'm talking with my hands or I'm, speaking with emotion, you see that I'm being legitimate in the way I speak. And I still think that video is a very, very powerful tool in the journalism scene. It has evolved the way we consume news today, and especially now with the rise of virtual reality, it will continue to really change our perception of journalism daily. So I love writing, but I definitely would say that video has just as much as an important spot, if not potentially more important than writing in some way.
Okay, and it sounds like you're breaking news here on the Sports Lobbies podcast that On Batting Order is going to have a virtual reality episode soon.
I'm hoping. I'm trying to brew up something. I actually do want to go to the NBA draft this year, so I'm trying to see if I can first get the media pass. So if anybody from the NBA is listening to this podcast, call me, and I definitely want to see if there's some way that I could get a 360 camera, because I really do want to change the way we consume content. I'm always thinking of ways to be different. I never, ever, ever want to be in a comfort zone. And much like you, I know, and a lot of my other peers, all our peers in the sports law industry, don't want to be in this comfort zone in their careers or in their professions. And I definitely don't want to be that one person that will just keep law and batting order in a very consistent plane. I'm always thinking of new and creative ways to engage the audience. And actually, with law and batting order being in its 5th year anniversary this year, I definitely am anticipating some massive changes to law and batting order. So yes, I think virtual reality is very much on the rise very, very, very soon.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, we've talked about how you do all this work, you produce the product, you know, you're commenting, you're very active on Twitter and in sports law chats and things like that. I think one question that I have personally for you is how you balance doing all these things in sports law and then everything else going on in your life.
You would think that I'm like on this adrenaline high, that I'm like, I have like a IV connected to my veins with coffee, but frankly, no, unfortunately not. I think it's just a matter of allocating time. So, you know, for me, obviously family comes first. So I know that if I have a family commitment or if I have any other obligations to life in general, I always commit that first and foremost, then followed by my own career. By day, I'm a business affairs manager at Corpus Entertainment. So I know that work always comes first, even before law and batting order. But when I have the time to really devote my energy to law and batting order, I will work in the best interest of promoting law and batting order. And that means connecting with all my friends at the, you know, during the sports law chat conversation, or, you know, engaging with our peers on Twitter. Even Law News has now creeped its way into the picture here. And even then, I still make time for that, because I know that I'm promoting the law and batting order brand in a very unique way. So it is hard to allocate the time, but I think that I've managed to sort of get the kinks out. You know, certainly whenever I add something new to my plate, it gets a little rough at first, but I've definitely rebounded very quickly. And I learned that, you know, there's a time and place for everything. So I know I'm not expending too much time on one thing more than the other. I think that has definitely worked to my advantage.
Yeah, no, and then that's a real skill in today's society is finding ways to allocate your time and do what matters most.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, yeah, I think we're just about done here. I don't know, is there any current issue you want to talk about, or you want to save that for your show?
Oh, well, I'll just say really quickly, you know, one thing that I think is fascinating as we head into 2016 already is domestic violence and sexual assaults continues to be a daily headline. And I know that what's been going on in the University of Tennessee from a legal perspective is fascinating, as multiple women have filed a Title IX lawsuit against the university. They allege sexual assault by UT football and basketball players, and their allegation further states that the school had knowledge of it and didn't do anything. So that's a big mess. And then on top of that, we are potentially going to see some massive suspensions in Major League Baseball as they are in full force and, you know, enforcing their domestic violence policy. We had Jose Reyes just this week be placed on a paid administrative leave. So I have a feeling that his suspension will be coming soon. His domestic violence incident happened on Halloween Day in 2015, when he allegedly shoved his wife against a sliding glass door in their hotel room in Hawaii. We have the Yasiel Puig incident also in 2015, where he was in a fight with his sister. And then you have Aroldis Chapman, the new Yankees closer, who I think is the baddest of the bunch, because although he faced no charges, there is an undisputed fact that he fired 8 gunshots as a result of a confrontation that he had with his girlfriend, and there were people around. So easily that gunshot, any of those 8 gunshots, could have struck and potentially killed somebody. So Rob Manfred has his plate full in terms of enforcing those policies. From a legal perspective, it's fascinating, specifically because it's all about due process at this point. I think we've seen how Deflategate rolls out. You know, Deflategate was all about, was the punishment that Tom Brady faced fair, and Judge Berman ruled that it was not fair, and now we're in the appeals process. And now at this point with Major League Baseball's domestic violence policy, they don't have a set number of games as a punishment. They don't have a base number. So at this point, it's about the commissioner, in his best interest, deeming a certain number of game suspensions being the just punishment here. And it's a matter of whether that punishment will be fair. And you bet your bottom dollar that those players, especially in the MLB scene, will be filing appeals and making some type of due process arguments. So it's definitely a headline to watch. And also, I think one other note, it'll be interesting to see how other leagues continue to enforce their domestic violence policies, especially in the NFL, since it's thanks to them that we are now fully aware of how much of an epidemic domestic violence is in the sports scene. It has been before the Ray Rice scandal. I acknowledged it many a time, you know, personally, even before Law and Batting Order. I've been unfortunately aware of how domestic violence is an issue in society in general, and it continues to be a problem now. And I think that if leagues continue to step up to the plate and do their job in enforcing those rules, I think we'll hopefully see some changes in the future.
Yeah, no, and like you said, obviously it's not a problem unique to pro sports, sadly, but it is the enforcement mechanisms that these leagues have some problems.
Yes.
And so they need to come up with better systems to deal with this, because it's the fact that this happens at all is sad. And then the fact that, you know, the alleged perpetrators can get off scot-free is a result of the failure of leagues to have enforceable policies against them.
I mean, so it's good that they have the discussions in place and they have whatever is, you know, their domestic violence policy in place. You know, they sort of laid the groundwork, but that's step one. Now, step two, all the way to infinity, is to make sure that they continue to refine the policy so that it's a workable and solid policy. I mean, Major League Baseball's drug testing policy is a perfect example, because back in 2005, when Rafael Palmeiro was suspended 10 games, that was a large suspension. Whereas today, if you're a first-time offender for using performance-enhancing drugs, that's an 80-game suspension. So we have seen some massive strides and evolutions in many policies across the league, and the domestic violence policy across all the four major sports leagues in the U.S. It'll be interesting to see how they continue to evolve in the coming days, weeks, months, and years, for sure.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing your thoughts on that and everything else here today. We're getting near the end of our time here. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we sign off?
Just feel free to follow me on Law and Batting Order. I love connecting with everybody. So first, you can check out Law and Batting Order at lawandbattingorder.com. You can see all the various episodes that I've covered on my show. You can follow me on Twitter at lawandbo. You can also follow me on Instagram at that same handle. And I'm on Facebook. You just search in the search bar Law and Batting Order. I'm there. And if you want to connect with me personally, I'm at A. Ilya Costas on Twitter. And, you know, like Peter and I had said before, we are resources for the sports law community. Whether you're a sports law student or you're a professional who's been working in this industry for many, many years, I continue to make my brand in legal journalism. I hope to really make Law and Batting Order something unique and special in the coming years. And if you're somebody who is passionate about sports law and just wants some tips, you know, connect with me. That's what I'm here to do. That's what everybody in the sports law community is here to do. We want to help our peers. At least I know I do, and definitely Peter does. So don't hesitate. If you have any questions whatsoever, if you want to talk sports law, or you just want to break into, you want questions about how to break into sports law, that's what I'm here to do.
Yeah, and I echo everything Tony said. So thanks for coming on the podcast here today, and we'll look for your work at Law and Batting Order and see where you go from there.
Thanks so much, Peter. Appreciate your interview.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend Lieb Montoya for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is at Lieb Montoya in both places. That's at L-I-B Montoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank a musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, at PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, at SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.